We're ready to run down the top news from this past week in Indiana agriculture. We're ready for Hoosier Ag This Week from Indiana's most listened to farm radio network, Hoosier Ag Today. We hope you had a great Thanksgiving, and if you're still celebrating this weekend, please do so safely. On today's show,
I'm CJ Miller. You'll hear from Caleb Ragland, president of the American Soybean Association, about the many challenges soybean growers have been facing. And I'll tell you about a major beef production facility in Nebraska that is shutting down.
I'm Greg Allen. Beef producers are working to bring more ag education to the classroom, and we'll discuss the evolving landscape for buying used farm equipment.
I'm Andy Eubank. We have seen some strength in the corn and bean markets in this holiday shortened week of trade. We'll report on how things ended up in just a few minutes.
And I'm Eric Pfeiffer. We'll also hear about how trade with China is about more than just tariffs. Ryan Martin's Indiana Farm Forecast is on the way, but let's begin by looking ahead to the 2026 season and how much you might be paying for fertilizer. The prices you're paying right now remain sky high. Will that change for next year? CJ Miller reports.
It's a tough year in 2025. 2026 doesn't look a lot better.
And that's Josh Linville, vice president of fertilizer with StoneX. He says we're still seeing global supply issues for phosphate.
China's normally the world's largest exporter of phosphate. They normally export 8 to 10 million ton. I will be thrilled if they hit 4.5 million ton this year. And unfortunately, there's nobody to fill that gap. The global S&D for phosphate is very, very tight, and that's why you're seeing the price as high as it is.
However, he says that farmers could see relief when it comes to urea prices in 2026.
We've seen a lot more exports from China, which is a massive improvement over 2024. Europe is still going to struggle with their production rate. That's not expected to end anytime soon. Middle East has found peace. That's hopeful that we're not going to see war impact that production. So I feel like the nitrogen sector is in a better shape.
Any changes for potash in 2026?
Potash is still in good shape. It's just a logistical game. It's gone back to being potash, boring old potash.
He says it does help that potash is being mined just north of the U.S. in nearby Canada.
Potash, we are already a massive, massive manufacturer. I'm saying this from a Canadian standpoint. They're the biggest producer and exporter by far. We've already got enough supply there, but that's where the money has been flowing to open up some mines in the U.S. I love it for the farmers around those mines. That is going to help their pricing.
He adds that the problems with the pricing and availability of farm fertilizers stem from the fact that the U.S. is heavily reliant on importing the supply when some of that fertilizer could be produced here domestically.
I think the one thing we can do the most with is nitrogen production. We're a net importer. We have some of the best natural gas supplies in the world. We have some of the lowest prices of gas in the world. We have some of the most politically stable countries in the world. And people say, well, it's a dirty production. We can produce it cleaner than the rest of the world. Our standards are going to be higher than what other people can do. So let's produce this at home. Let's build those plants here and quit being reliant on tons coming from like Russia and the Middle East and things like that.
Read more at HoosierAgToday.com. I'm CJ Miller.
Tar spot has been the big corn disease we've discussed for the past several years. And there was some this year, but it certainly didn't win the 2025 award for biggest yield robber.
I have never seen the level of southern rust pressure across the Corn Belt like we did in 2025.
Kim Tudor is the technical marketing manager for plant health at BASF.
It caught people off guard. Generally speaking, it doesn't come across the Corn Belt until much later because it blows in from the Gulf of Mexico, you know, and sometimes it comes in super late in the season. But that disease is particularly troublesome because it has a really fast reproductive cycle. Its latent period is only 7 to 10 days, so every week, generally speaking, it's putting off new spores. And so when it comes in, it hits hard.
And Tudor says 2025 wasn't just a year of southern rust and tar spot either.
There was gray leaf spot too. Some fields had northern corn leaf blight. So it was truly a complex of diseases. That corn seed was fighting from the time it went in the ground.
With all those challenges, farmers who chose to cut fungicide from the budget this year likely struggled. Tudor says we can all be a little short-sighted, including her, when it comes to fungicide decisions. You can get caught looking at just the most recent year.
When you look at a performance-driven fungicide like Veltima, and you look at its performance year over year over year, it continues to deliver that yield benefit, that stress mitigation benefit. And it's that consistency that pays for itself.
She shared with me a story of an Iowa grower who decided to apply fungicide to a smaller number of acres. His conclusion at the end of the season?
He said, if you ever let me not treat all my corn acres again. Please hit me upside the head with a 2x4. And I think that sums it up really well.
Tudor encourages farmers to have conversations about fungicide now. She even suggests taking advantage of BASF's 0% financing and booking the application if you're thinking about applying Veltima aerially. You can hear more from Tudor in the Full Hat interview by finding this story at HoosierAgToday.com. The Indiana Farm Forecast with Chief Meteorologist Ryan Martin is on the way in just minutes. But right now, let's turn our attention to the markets. It was a shortened week of holiday trade. Here to tell us all about it is Andy Eubank.
Hey, thanks, Eric. The corn and bean markets finished higher all session. As a matter of fact, it ended a little over an hour earlier than usual. Final numbers coming up. We'll begin with market commentary, analyzing what happened during the week and on Friday specifically. I checked in with Mike Castle at StoneX. A short session on Friday to wrap up a holiday shortened week because of Thanksgiving. And we saw some gains, Mike, in the markets both on Wednesday and then some follow-through buying on Friday for corn and soybeans. Going into the opening of the session, we did get some positive export news, some flash sales announcements as well. Did those play a role in the higher move?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I mean, as you kind of alluded to there with the short session, kind of a quiet week in general, obviously with the holiday here. So not a ton of, you know, at least U.S. data coming out. So anytime, you know, you kind of get some actual positive news like that, I think the market's happy to see it. It was 312,000 met tons of beans sold to China for this marketing year. And then a more interesting one, about 274,000 met tons of corn to unknown destinations. And obviously, we won't know, until that gets classified where it's going. But, the fact that it's coming in at the same time as this China sale, if that was, you know, a corn sale of U.S. corn to China, that would be a pretty big development. We're already looking at record export pace on the corn side. We're getting our delayed export sales from USDA. Those continue to impress with every week that we get. On the inspection side, the data we've been getting throughout the shutdown, we're up 72% year on year. We're over 9% ahead of the pace needed to hit USDA's would-be record 3.075 billion bushel export target. So if you throw in some China business on top of that, that just makes things look even better on the export side. And again, that's not to say that this is coming directly off of ending stocks with the huge feed number that USDA has out there, but it does at least make that less of a factor kind of weighing on, kind of hanging over our heads, so to speak. And again, the soybean side, nice to see these flash sales, but we kind of need this to continue pretty much, I don't want to say every day, but it pretty regularly here now through the end of the year to hit that 12 million met ton, which is around 440 million bushel target that was reported from our end that they've yet to confirm on their side. And, at the same time, I think it's important to keep in mind if we do hit that target, we sell that 440 million to China, we would still need our second biggest non-China sales of all time to meet USDA's current target.
Mike Castle there, market intelligence and senior fertilizer analyst at StoneX. Now, settlements from the short day of trade on Friday. Deese corn up 3.75, 435.5. March contract goes up 2.5, 447.75. January beans led the way higher, up 6.25, 1137.75. March contract, 1146, up 1.25. It was mostly lower in wheat. December did go up 2 cents, 531. March wheat, 538.5, down 2 cents. And mixed in the meats, December live cattle, 215.57, up $4.55. February contract, 492 higher. And in hogs, December lean hogs, 80.60, up 17. February contract, 37 cents lower at $81 even. And that's the market update section of the weekend show. There's much more still to come. I'm Andy Eubank. This is Hoosier Ag This Week.
After years of dedication, Jim and Jody Johnson are retiring and selling their quality farm equipment through Purple Wave's December 30th Ag Auction. Don't miss their 2024 John Deere ExactEmerge 1775 NT Planter and 2019 John Deere S760 Combine. See the equipment yourself during open inspections at Osage, Iowa on Wednesday, December 17th and Monday, December 29th, both from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visit purplewave.com for a complete listing. Purple Wave Auctions, straight, simple, sold.
The Indiana Farm Forecast on Hoosier Ag This Week is presented by the Indiana Ag Nutrient Alliance. We've got a major winter storm complex making its way through this weekend. Here to tell us about it is Chief Meteorologist Ryan Martin.
We've got a monster area of low pressure coming together in parts of the Central Plains. It really put the whole package together overnight last night. Now it's kicking eastward, so clouds will be increasing very, very quickly here today. And I'm looking for precipitation to nose into northwestern parts of Indiana, probably at or just ahead of midday. Now remember, this weather system is coming into an already cold air mass. Just go back into where it was or how it was for Thanksgiving Day and yesterday. We've got plenty of cold air, so there's no question this is bringing snow. It really comes down to how much, and for that we have to watch the track of the low. Right now I have that low tracking through north central parts of Illinois through this afternoon, getting into the Chicago, Porter County, Lake County, Indiana, Berrien County, Michigan area as we go past midnight tonight, and then tracking right across lower Michigan. I think it's going to take a line from Benton Harbor to probably Bad Axe. The tip of the thumb is likely where this low goes through Sunday morning and midday. The biggest snows always happen within about 50 miles of that core of low pressure, oftentimes to the north and northwest side. Now, that doesn't mean that Indiana completely escapes. I just think that we aren't quite the biggest snow totals out there in this system as it passes through. The track of the low is very important, of course, but I think that we are on the not as bad side. That being said, what are we talking about here? I'm still holding firm with 2 to 8 inches of general coverage over central and northern Indiana. Where it gets a little bit more interesting is in southern Indiana. I think there can be a little bit of rain mixing with snow down there, and the moisture is just not as impressive. But even in southern Indiana, a coating to an inch is possible. That 2 to 8 inch total blankets a lot of the central and north. You get closer to Lake Michigan, you get closer to that lake and Porter County area, LaPorte County. I also think that we can see totals a little bit stronger there. Could get in double digits, I suppose, but we'll just have to see. I'm taking a very conservative approach to this. Here's the deal. Whether you get 2 inches, 8 inches, 12 inches, the way this system is coming through means it's not going to be nice no matter what. The snow is wet, and it's going to stick to roads because it is cold. Speaking of that, as this thing kicks out Sunday afternoon, we're going to be behind it with a dry week for the most part. The only thing that we see, maybe a few flurries on Tuesday across Indiana with more clouds, but otherwise no major precipitation all this week, but we remain very cold. I'm Ryan Martin.
The end of the year reinforces the value of collaboration. From neighbors lending a hand to partners sharing know-how, teamwork is essential and is how Indiana Ag Nutrient Alliance operates on its mission of enabling viable farms, healthy soil, and clean water. Indiana's ag and commodity groups, alongside state government and conservation leaders, work together to vet practices that improve the environment while protecting farmers' bottom line. Helping Indiana farmers thrive is a win for all. And we're back with more Hoosier Ag This Week. I'm Greg Allen with this segment, and I trust you all had a great Thanksgiving and got plenty to eat. As we continue with the news that impacted the world of agriculture this week, the Cattlemen's Beef Board and the American Farm Bureau Federation have joined forces on a nationwide effort to teach students where their food really comes from.
It's basically a science-based educational program.
That's Secretary Treasurer of the Cattlemen's Beef Board, Terry Quam.
They go into science classes in our high schools, in our middle schools, and teach about beef. And it's funded by the beef, your beef checkoff, and all they do is teach beef.
The in-school educational program sends farmers, ranchers, and agricultural experts directly into the classrooms. Their mission is to help kids understand how beef is raised, how ranchers care for their animals, and the role cattle play in food production and sustainability.
Last year, they just won one of the most prestigious Next Gen Science Awards, which is only given out to the top 1% of educational material programs, and that is in our high schools. Today, we have 1.3 million students being educated by our checkoff dollars and getting the message out there of to those kids by us through science-based back curriculum that is out there counteracting, because we all know we got people out there giving them data that maybe isn't correct and they have a political motive behind them.
The goal? Build understanding, spark curiosity, and create a stronger connection between the next generation and the nation's food system.
Well, Thursday was Thanksgiving Day, and you may have had turkey with your loved ones, but many folks were enjoying a delicious baked ham over the holidays as well. C.J. Miller reports on the push to drive more international demand for ham and other U.S. pork products in 2026.
Pork is still very robust. Even in light of all the headwinds in terms of geopolitics, demand for meat is strong.
And that's Andy Tower, Vice President of International Market Development for the National Pork Board. He's also an Indiana farmer based in Morgan County. Even though U.S. pork exports to China were down 13% in the first 7 months of this year, largely due to the trade war with China, Tower says he's encouraged by the recent trade agreement between the Trump administration and the Chinese government.
We've got a president that's having a conversation about trade, so it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, at least we're getting it out in front. A lot of the agreements announcements have been out thus far. We haven't saw a lot of the paper and a lot of the finer details behind it. And so we did see some positive moves in terms of 10% tariff reduction on pork into China. So that's an improvement, but we're still not back to the tariff levels we were a year ago. But we're very pleased where we sit getting closer to the end of the year.
Outside of China and the Asian market, Tower says the biggest areas for the continued growth for U.S. pork exports has been to our south.
Mexico, Central America, and South America continue to buy large volumes of U.S. pork, and really the Colombian market continues to really perform well and is really a kind of shining star here in 2025.
Read more and check out more of my conversation with Andy Tower. It's at HoosierAgToday.com. I'm C.J. Miller.
Thank you, C.J. Trade remains an issue with U.S. exports, but tariffs aren't the only reason why. Sophia Shannon has more.
President Trump's recent meeting with Chinese President Xi dropped current tariff rates for inbound pork 10%, allowing business to continue. However, beef exports to China have issues bigger than the tariffs.
Since April, virtually all of our plants, 400-plus establishments between slaughter establishments and cold storages have not been relisted for China. And it's not demand related. Demand was fantastic last year, $1.6 billion in sales on U.S. beef to China. And we still, our largest customers are still demanding it today. They're ready to start tomorrow as soon as plants are relisted.
That was Dan Holstrom, president of U.S. Meat Export Federation. Both USTR and the USDA are aware of the issues and are working to come to a solution.
The demand for U.S. beef in particular, and pork, but in this case beef, is good in the rest of the world. Very good. In fact, record-breaking in some places. So when you think about the record pricing earlier this year, and the demand still being good in a lot of these markets, I think we're in a very good place.
Holstrom sees many opportunities with both the United Kingdom and the European Union for accessible markets. At the same time, progress is being made with Indonesia, allowing some sales to happen.
We're the gold standard in food safety. If you see a USDA establishment number of XYZ as an example in any market around the world, that in itself is a selling point.
U.S. meats continue to be the preferred meat around the world. Holstrom and USMEF are looking to tackle these restriction issues around the globe. I'm Sophia Shannon.
And thank you, Sophia. The closure of one of Tyson's major beef plants in Nebraska is sending shockwaves throughout the entire U.S. beef industry. C.J. Miller has more.
I'm just in shock along with everybody else.
And that's David Jobman, a cattle producer who lives near Lexington, Nebraska, where the plant is located. And that plant handles about 5,000 head a day and accounts for about 5% of the average daily total U.S. beef slaughter. He thought it was a joke at first, but quickly learned that Tyson's announcement that the plant was closing was no laughing matter.
I'm sure the decision was not made lightly, but that's going to have a huge impact that's going to ripple across the communities around here.
When Tyson announced they were shutting down that particular plant on November 21st, live cattle futures opened limit down. Jobman says the closure will have a negative impact on thousands of beef producers who operate near that Tyson plant in central Nebraska.
pretty good area that was bringing fattened cattle to Lexington for slaughter. And now you're going to have to find other markets, and added transportation costs are certainly going to be a factor in decision in that.
The announcement comes just weeks after President Trump said he was directing the Department of Justice to investigate the big four U.S. meat packers, including Tyson. Those companies dominate 85% of the U.S. beef processing industry. Tyson says it's laying off 3,200 workers when that plant closes its doors on January 20th. I'm CJ Miller.
Find all of these stories and more at HoosierAgToday.com. Stick around, there's one more segment to go here on Hoosier Ag This Week. I'm Greg Allen.
AgBioScience, the number one ag tech podcast globally, is now available on video. Hear the latest from innovators in food, animal health, plant science, ag tech, and agriculture.
We as consultants can pass on, and we certainly do that. That's part of our charge. If we see we're working for our members, Kayla, so their best interest is what's first in our mind. And so if there's something that we can do that will help them or prevent them in terms of technology adoption, whether that's tillage practices, whether that's software, whether that's hardware, whether that's technology fees of some type, it's our duty a little bit to make sure that we're aware of all those things, and that if we have folks who have tried and tested those things, that we pass that on in terms of what works or maybe what doesn't work, or if they're thinking about doing something, connecting them to the people that we think does that right.
Get more episodes online at agrinovusindiana.com. Click on podcasts. Also available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back. Thanks for hanging with us on Hoosier Ag This Week, making us part of your Thanksgiving weekend. I'm Eric Pfeiffer from Hoosier Ag Today. We've seen soybean prices on the rise after China recently ended their boycott of U.S. soybeans after a new trade agreement was signed. CJ Miller reports now on how soybean producers still face a number of challenges heading into next year.
American soybean farmer desperately needs that market and that opportunity.
And that's Caleb Ragland, president of the American Soybean Association, who told me he's encouraged by the new trade deal.
It's going to be really exciting when we actually see those soybeans being unloaded and we see cash on the barrel head and that deal is completed, because historically there's been times where there's been some seesawing and back and forth and cancellations and movement and so forth, but we have confidence that we will get substantial sales made.
Ragland says he's also encouraged by the Trump administration's proposed $12 to $13 billion farm aid package for farmers who were negatively impacted by the recent trade war with China.
We were already facing some struggles within the farm economy, and this made things far worse for many operations. And a financial bridge in order to help recover from some of those losses is vital that that gets done. And it needs to happen sooner than later, because there's a lot of operations that are severely hurting financially, some that won't be in business in 2026 if something doesn't change.
He adds that lawmakers in D.C. still need to pass an updated farm bill in 2026.
We haven't been prioritized in getting this done. I know that our leadership in both parties wants to see it happen within the ag circles, but you get outside of the ag committee, sometimes I feel like we get lost.
Read the full story. It's at HoosierAgToday.com.
Thank you, CJ. For decades, selling a tractor or combine meant hauling it to a live auction, paying transport costs, and hoping for a good crowd. But now, online-only auction companies are giving sellers a more efficient option. Greg Allen has the story.
These platforms allow farmers to list equipment directly from their farm, eliminating the need to move it until it's sold. According to Doug Maynor of Purple Wave,
we take a lot of the guesswork out of the auction business. So what we really try to do is create an environment of trust for folks to know that, hey, with the way we partner with our sellers, it's a little different than like other traditional auction companies that create an event, or they create like, hey, let's go out and sell this guy's farm. We do that, but we also look at doing things one-off or item specific. And that's really where we changed the marketplace.
Industry analysts say that's not just convenient, it's profitable. Online auctions dramatically expand the buyer pool, pulling in bidders from across the country rather than just a single region. More bidders often means higher final prices, especially for well-maintained equipment.
It opens up your audience. And so your audience now is nationwide or also worldwide. We've actually had a lot of buyers from Mexico, a lot of buyers from Canada that can look at your items and they can determine hey, we understand the cost of getting that truck or that tractor from Kansas to Nebraska or Kansas to Florida. They know that number. They can anticipate what that is, and they can determine whether they want to bid on it or not.
For producers looking to turn unused iron into income, the click of a mouse may now be the most powerful tool in the shed. I'm Greg Allen, Hoosier Ag Today, Indiana's Farm Network.
Climate smart agriculture. It's a term we heard a lot during the previous presidential administration. With each new administration, priorities obviously shift. But just because we don't hear buzzwords or buzz terms like that, it doesn't mean conservation practices aren't a priority.
I've talked to the chief a number of times about where do we want this administration's NRCS policy, where do we want their head at?
That's Richard Fordyce, USDA Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation.
It's all about putting voluntary conservation on agriculture land all day, every day, period. Right? No other political statements, no other kind of priorities, but putting conservation on agriculture land voluntarily.
Fordyce, a farmer from Missouri, says he spent most of his adult life advocating for soil conservation and water quality improvements, having served as chair of the Missouri Soil and Water Conservation Districts. He says that on their farm, they employ conservation practices, and if they find something new, they want to implement it. But from a policy perspective,
we're not telling anybody what they have to do. You know, a farmer can choose to implement whatever conservation practice is going to fit in their land, right? So like in Indiana, you've got a myriad of soil types. And so, you know, one conservation practice in one part of the state is going to work, and a lot of people, you know, subscribe to that. Another part of the state, it's going to be something different. And what's great about NRCS and that suite of conservation practices is we likely have something that will fit that farm the best for that geography where it's at.
Fordyce encourages farmers to reach out to NRCS to explore what assistance could be available for your farm. You can also reach out to organizations like the Indiana Ag Nutrient Alliance or the Conservation Cropping Systems Initiative. And hear more from Fordyce in the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. You can find it at HoosierAgToday.com and watch it on our Facebook page. And finally today, the Agricultural Leadership Program through Agri Institute is accepting applications for their next class. And full-time soybean and corn farmers who are accepted into the program can get a partial tuition scholarship from the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Read more on this and other stories at HoosierAgToday.com. We'll do this again next weekend. Same hat time, same hat channel. I'm Eric Pfeiffer, Hoosier Ag Today, Indiana's Farm Network.